I'm Lauren Layfield, and you're listening to Your Next Podcast. This is the podcast that brings you a different series every single week, helping you to find your new favourite show. So, Laura Whitmore and Ian Sterling, power couple of British media all over your telly and your radio. I love the both of them. I've worked with Ian before, just a legend. But did you know they're actually both massive true crime fans and that they've got a true crime podcast together? It's called Murder, They Wrote from the BBC, and they pick a different crime every week. So we're talking murder, mayhem, blackmail, betrayal, all of that stuff. And while you do get all of the grim, grisly details that you want, the two of them manage to have a very tasteful laugh along the way. This episode is about a missing boy from Texas reappearing halfway around the world, and it's a really unreal story. Give this a try. This is Murder, They Wrote.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello.
Good afternoon, good evening, or good night, or good morning to anyone.
Or as some of us say, hello.
Hello, everyone.
How was your healing head from being attacked last week?
Last week, I was brutally attacked on the tube. And
a man fell over.
It's been picked up in all major news outlets. In fact, it's been covered by several true crime podcasts.
It's the real crime, isn't it?
But I feel fine this week. And it's your turn to do the podcast, which is good.
I don't want to give away too much. This is such an unbelievable case. It's a juicy one. It's literally stranger than fiction. But I'm going to ask you one question, Ian, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever pretended to be someone you're not?
Yes.
Because you're good at doing accents and stuff.
We once to try and get side of stage at Tea in the Park to see somebody.
So
we, me and another bunch of comedians, because we had AAA passes because we were comedians.
Okay, so you had passes, so why did you have to pretend to be someone else?
We wanted to get side of stage to see what a band, I can't remember who it was.
Okay.
So we lied and told the security that we were Lewis Capaldi's cousins.
I believe that.
And we got all the way to the last security guard side of stage, and then he sort of got a bit dubious. We were also incredibly
So was it Lewis Capaldi you were watching?
No.
Oh, but then why would they let Lewis Capaldi's cousins watch and not you watch?
I think it was Ed Sheeran, actually, if I remember correctly. And we just said we're Lewis Capaldi's cousins.
Okay.
But they just, you know, I mean, you say anything with enough chest, it's fine.
Yeah, you probably didn't say it with enough.
No, well,
confidence.
We did at the start. We're pretty
then you
drunk
lost
as well.
Did you ever use a fake ID when you were younger?
No, never
did
got hold of the one. You didn't need to use fake. Girls don't need to use fake IDs.
I used fake ID. I remember wanting to celebrate my 18th birthday by going out, and like the Saturday, say, was like 3 days before my birthday.
Yeah.
I had to still use a fake ID 3 days before my 18th birthday. To go out for my 18th birthday.
I remember these weren't that strict back in the day. When I was like 17,
actually,
I got
mine everywhere. Wasn't fake. She was a real person. It was weird, though, at the time the bouncer was like, it's funny, you're already in here.
No way.
Don't break the law. Right, okay. I'm going to get on with this case because I'm really excited to see what you think. I don't know if you know this because there is a show about it that I've watched, but maybe not with you. Before I start, I want to warn listeners that there are some really dark elements within this story. First of all, there will be discussions around addiction, and there will also be a brief mention of abuse against children, including sexual assault. So listener caution is strongly advised. There will be a link in the show notes where you can find support on the issues that are raised in today's episode. Right, here we go.
You're listening to Murder, They Wrote with Laura Whitmore and Ian Sterling, a podcast where we indulge our favourite pastime, talking about true crime.
This is episode 31, The French Impressionist. We're starting today's episode in Texas. get that accent out of the way,
Howdy,
Ian.
Partners, there's a snake in my boot. Everything's bigger in Texas, including my face. I've got a big Texas face on me.
Are you done?
Yeah, I'm done, man.
It's mid-November 1997, and we're in a rundown housing complex in San Antonio, which is a big, sprawling city in southern Texas. Beverly Barclay is sitting in her small one-bedroom apartment. She's just woken up from a nap, having worked her regular graveyard shift at Dunkin' Donuts last night, 10 p.m. to 5 a.m., rough. She works the same shift 7 nights a week. Beverly is somewhere in her mid-50s. Her face is weathered from years of heavy drinking and drug taking. She's currently struggling with a heroin addiction. And her voice is gravelly and hard-edged, worn down by smoking multiple packs of cigarettes every day. Beverly is looking out the window, her eyes glazed over. Suddenly, the phone rings. Snapping her out of the daze, she goes to pick it up. "Hello," she says.
"Ma'am, this is Charlie Parker."
Beverly remembers that name. He's a private investigator. She met him only a week or so ago at her daughter Carrie's trailer. Charlie had arrived at the trailer with a TV crew. They were filming an episode of a new show called Hard Copy. They were interviewing her 16-year-old son, Nicholas. On the other side of the line, Charlie lets out a sigh.
"I need to talk to you about Nicholas," he says.
Beverly holds her breath. She's not sure she can handle much more. She's still reeling from what's been happening over the past few weeks. 3 years ago, her son Nicholas had gone missing. After months of searching in October, she finally got a call from the FBI. They'd found him in Spain. The family had been, of course, beyond relieved, as you can imagine. Beverly's daughter, Carrie, had flown thousands of miles to collect him and bring him home. Finally, Beverly had her baby back. "What about Nicholas?" Beverly asked Charlie. He let out another sigh. He struggles to find the words. This news will devastate Beverly. It will break her. How do you tell someone that the person they've welcomed back into their life, the person they believe to be their long-lost son, is actually a total stranger, a liar, a con man? All Charlie can muster up is,
"It's not him, ma'am. It's not him."
That is wild.
I know. Where do you even begin with this one? I thought I'd start by telling you about Nicholas Barclay and his disappearance. Because I feel like there's two parts to this story. There's the what happened beforehand and then the what happened afterwards.
Why he went missing in the first place.
Yeah. And then that leads you to another crime.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's go back because I love to go back. So Nicholas Barclay was born on December 31st, 1980. By all accounts, he was an angelic baby, bright blonde hair, piercing blue eyes. But this angelic young boy was born into a very difficult set of circumstances. His father was absent, and as I mentioned before, his mother, Beverly, was a heavy drinker, and she dealt with addiction issues throughout Nicholas's life. His half-brother, Jason, who was 8 years older than him, also struggled with addiction. Luckily, he also had a half-sister, Carrie. Now, she was 15 years older than him, and probably the only stable figure in his life.
Right, so things aren't easy for Nicholas, basically.
No, not at all. So, as you can imagine, this had a huge impact on him. Here's how The New Yorker describes him. Nicholas was a sweet, lonely, combustible kid who craved attention and was often in trouble at school.
Yeah, poor guy.
So let me take you to June 1994. Now, Nicholas is 13 years old. By this point, he already has a juvenile record for threatening his teachers and breaking into a convenience store. He also has a bunch of tattoos.
Who tattoos a 13-year-old?
Well, he has got a letter T on his left hand between his thumb and forefinger, the letter J on his left shoulder, and the letters L and N on the outside of his left ankle. The J may have been for Jason, for his brother maybe, but I don't know what the others are at all. Anyway, it's June the 13th and Nicholas has just had a huge argument with his mom. He's been caught stealing a pair of shoes. After this argument, Nicholas storms out of his mother's home and goes to a local basketball court to hang out with his friends. Sometime in the evening, he calls home. Jason picks up. Nicholas tells Jason that someone needs to drive over to the court and pick him up, but Jason refuses. He tells Nicholas that their mum is sleeping and he's not going to drive over. "You can walk home," Jason says before hanging up. But Nicholas never makes it home. And that evening, he disappears without a trace.
Imagine being Jason in that situation. That is,
you'd feel terrible. You'd never live with yourself.
So tragic.
So obviously an investigation is launched to try and find Nicholas, but the police can't find anything. After Nicholas disappears, the family completely falls apart. As you can imagine, horrific. Mm-hmm. Both Beverly and Jason's drug taking become even worse. Jason's behaviour becomes very erratic. At one point, he's arrested for using force against a police officer and Beverly has to kick him out of the house.
He must have been feeling so much guilt for just not picking up Nicholas that day.
Exactly, yes. So, a year passes. Then two. Then three. Nothing. No sign of Nicholas. Then in October 1997, the family gets a phone call. It's the FBI, and they have incredible news. They found Nicholas.
Oh my God, the elation you'd feel.
Exactly. I mean, for the Barclays, it feels like literally it's a miracle. The FBI tells them what's happened. An organization in Virginia named the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, or the NCMEC, have been contacted by someone called Jonathan Doreen. Now, Jonathan is the director of a youth shelter, and he has told the NCMEC that they currently have a young boy staying with them who they believe is Nicholas Barclay.
Brilliant.
So, of course, right away, the Barclays family asked the FBI, where is he? Where can we pick him up from? But they get the answer that they were not expecting. The FBI says he's in Spain.
Mad you get like a kid smuggled essentially from Texas to Spain.
I mean, this How'd is what the it? Family are wondering. Like, yeah. How did that happen? Like, not even a different state, like a different continent.
Yeah, it's hard enough to get like a stolen, like a missing persons over state lines, yeah. Let alone on a plane.
So the first thing they do is ask to be put on the phone with Nicholas. When the FBI connects them, Carrie, the sister, remember her? She's the one a little bit more together.
Yeah.
She's the first person to speak to him. My God, Nikki, is that you? She says. She hears someone speak on the other end. It's very muffled. She can just about make out what he says.
Yes, it's me.
Then Beverly takes the phone and she hears him say,
I want to come home.
A few days later, Carrie gets on a flight and travels thousands of miles to a city called Linares in the southern part of Spain. When she arrives, she's greeted by an official from the US Embassy and two of them go to the shelter where Nicholas is living. Carrie is taken into a room and asked to wait. They'll go get Nicholas and bring him in. Now remember, it's been 3 years since Carrie last saw her little brother. He was 13, so now he'd be 16. A lot can change in those years.
Loads of change, especially if, you know, puberty is involved and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, voice changing, growth, you know, looks so
become
different.
Become a different person, that sort of stuff.
Well, literally. So Carrie sits and waits. After a few minutes, the door opens. And standing in the doorway is a short, slim boy dressed in scruffy clothes. But Carrie can't see his face. He's wearing sunglasses. He's wrapped a scarf around most of his face and put a cap on. But Carrie doesn't care. She rushes across the room and pulls her brother into a hug. She's overwhelmed with emotion. Nicholas, on the other hand, is awkward and stiff and barely says a word. The two siblings are left alone together. Carrie has brought pictures with her. She takes them out to show Nicholas. Look, this is Mum now, she says. This is Grandpa. But Nicholas nods along. He remains pretty mute. And whenever he does anything, Carrie is pretty sure that she can hear an accent. Not American, not Spanish, a French accent. Then after a few hours, he removes his cap. His hair is blonde, like Nicholas. But it looks like it's dyed blonde. A while later, Nicholas removes his sunglasses. To Carrie's shock, she sees that his eyes are brown. That's not how she remembers them.
Well, yeah, they said they were blue at the beginning.
Exactly, so hold that thought. Once the siblings are reunited, the authorities begin organising Nicholas's return trip to the US of A. In order to get him a passport, Carrie has to swear under oath that this boy is her brother, which she does. Now, I'm going to show you two photos. This is Nicholas before he went missing, and then after he returned.
They are similar, you know.
You think? He's got a different jawline.
Yeah, but like, he's got muscly, isn't he? He's got muscly over the years. I would...
I mean, one's got blue eyes and one's got brown eyes.
I would say that they could arguably be the same person, but it wouldn't have been over the course of 3 years. That looks like a sort of 15 years later vibe.
But look at his hair. Like, his hair's clearly dyed. Do you not think he looks like his skin is more sallow?
Yeah, and his nose is a different shape. His eyes are a different colour.
His jawline.
His jaw's a different shape.
Ears I don't think he looks anything like him.
Yeah. I think it's close enough, though.
I feel like I shouldn't have asked you that question.
It's closer than I thought.
You're going to be like, Laura's already home. I'm living with this other woman. I'm like, that's not mean.
I mean, what a get a jail free card. An affair? I thought I could have sworn you.
I thought it was you.
That was you.
When the plane landed in San Antonio Airport on October 18th, 1997, as you can imagine, there's a group of people waiting to see Nicholas.
Probably some cameras and stuff as well.
Beverly's there, along with Carrie's husband, Brian Gibson, and Carrie's two children, her 14-year-old son, Cody, and 10-year-old daughter, Chantelle. The only person missing is Jason, Nicholas's brother. Do you remember?
Yeah, you would have thought.
He was the one that he called.
Yeah,
to
you would have thought
him.
He'd be the first person to see them. He'd want to see him the most because he might help hold himself responsible in a way. That's weird. How come he wasn't there?
We'll come to that later. So when Nicholas arrives back in San Antonio, he moves into Carrie's trailer. Beverly works the night shift and they're too worried to leave Nicholas alone after, I mean, all he's been through the last 3 years. So instead, he lives with Carrie, Brian and their kids. A few days after arriving home, Nicholas is asked to come for an interview with an FBI agent named Nancy Fisher. Nancy needs to learn what happened to Nicholas after he was abducted in order to try and track down the people who did it. So this is where things are going to get really dark. Some of these details, they are actually crucial to the story, which is why I'm telling you. Nicholas' story to the FBI goes like this. So he's saying this is what happened to him since. On the evening of June 13th, 1994, he was just about to leave the basketball court when two boys he didn't recognise came up to him and said hi. The next thing he knew, he felt a cloth over his mouth and he passed out. When he woke up, he was in a room with a group of other kids. Now, Nicholas says he eventually figured out that he and these other children had been drugged and flown out of America in a military plane. The people who abducted them were high-ranking military officials. When asked where they were from, he says the officials were American, European, and Mexican. Over the next 3 years, Nicholas and the other children were subjected to unimaginable forms of torture. They were beaten and raped. They had headphones placed on their heads, which would have people screaming and yelling in different languages. Another time, a voice would be played over and over and over again saying, "You are not you." If the children were heard speaking English, they were beaten. Most shockingly of all, Nicholas says that he and other kids were experimented on, including one experiment that saw them have their eyes injected with a chemical that made them change colour.
I've never heard of something like that.
No, neither had the FBI. But this was Nicholas's story. And when asked how he escaped, he simply said that one day they left the door unlocked and he ran out.
That is a lot to take in.
So once Nicholas has given the FBI this information, he is free to return to his old life and try as much as possible to go back to normal. But obviously, nothing about this situation is normal. There's just so much that's different about Nicholas. But the family, I mean, assuming this is all the result of severe trauma he's experienced, mm-hmm. they don't actually say anything. They just try to get on with things. They just like take him in as their own, even though something isn't adding up here. The only person who doesn't make any effort with Nicholas is Jason. It takes him about a month, I think, to come and visit his brother.
A month? That mm-hmm. seems ages.
And when he does, he only stays for about half an hour. He barely looks at Nicholas. So now we're in November 1997, and I want to return to someone we've met before. Charlie Parker, do you remember?
Yes, the guy on the phone at the beginning, the private detective.
Exactly, the private investigator. As I said at the beginning, he became involved in this story because of some work he did with a news program called Hard Copy. Basically, when Hard Copy heard about the incredible story of Nicholas Barclay returning home after 3 years of torture, they wanted to interview him. So they hired Charlie Parker to track down where he was living so they could set up the interview. Charlie was able to track down Nicholas. So he set the whole thing up and he came along to the interview too. So, he was there with the Hard Copy crew on November 6th, 1997. Here's how Charlie describes what happened next. And I actually got a quote from him.
That's good. I love direct quotes.
From a Netflix documentary called The Imposter. They set him up, put a microphone on him, and had the cameras on him. And I moved over behind a booth. It was almost fate. Behind that booth was a picture of the actual Nicholas Barclay. And I could look at that picture and look at him at the same time. And as I looked at the picture, I noticed that the boy had blue, grey-looking eyes and this man had brown eyes. It was a moment where the hair stood at the back of your neck and there was just something wrong about it. Something was wrong.
Yeah, but if you're buying Nicholas's story about the experiments that change eye colour.
Wow. The next thing Charlie noticed was his ears. As Charlie explains, he knew that the ears were important because he'd heard that Scotland Yard had tracked down James Earl Ray, the man who killed Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
They spotted him in Heathrow Airport because of his ears.
Is that true?
I'm actually not too sure, but there is a record of that being the case. Either way, Charlie feels he's onto something with ears. Here's another quote, right? Direct quote from Charlie Parker. When I got back to the office, I put the pictures in Adobe Photoshop. They were different ears. And so I knew right away that absolutely he was not Nicholas Barclay.
So that's the man he called Beverly.
Well, actually, he did a bit more digging first. Don't forget, he's, you know, a professional investigator. He knows what he's doing. He calls some ophthalmologists, so basically eye doctors, to ask if you can permanently change the colour of someone's eyes. They said no. And then he called a dialect expert to ask if you can ever really lose your native accent. And he said no.
I mean, I'd say those two things are pretty... I don't know how this got to the family originally. It's like, oh, he's lost his accent and his eyes have changed colour and they've still contacted the family. I'd love to know how that happened. Anyway, but maybe I'll find out.
Wow. He does call San Antonio police to report the findings. But get this, they ignore him.
Well, they're like, we found a boy.
Case closed, no more admin on this case.
He wasn't an issue before and he's now less of an issue, so we're not going to make him an issue.
So then he feels the right thing to do is to call Beverly and tell her that the boy who's been living with them for over a month is not her son. He said, actually, he was worried for her safety because who is this man?
It could be anyone, literally. Yeah. So what happens now?
I'll tell you. After the break. Okay, Ian, I think everyone needs a recap because there was quite an intense first half.
Yeah, correct. Right, okay, so we've got a 13-year-old boy, Nicholas Barclay. He went missing on June 1994. There's no trace of him for 3 years until suddenly, out of the blue, his family get a call saying he's in Spain. When Nicholas returns home, he explains that he was abducted and taken to Spain by military officials, high-ranking military officials, who made him change his accent and somehow did experiments on him that changed his eye colour. But now there's a private detective, he's called Charlie Parker, he's on the case, and he's certain that this boy who came back from Spain is not who he says he is. Thank you. Summary over.
Excellent work, Mrs. Sterling.
Perfect. Thank you.
Right, so in part one, I told you about Nicholas Barclay. Mm-hmm. Now I need to tell you about someone else. Frédéric Pierre Bourdin.
Wait, who's Frédéric Pierre Bourdin?
He is the 23-year-old Frenchman who has been impersonating 16-year-old Nicholas Barclay from Texas.
No, 23. I thought he looked well old in that picture. I assumed that wasn't like from when he was 16. I assumed that was even further down the line because he looks like a man. That's wild. Who is he? How? What's going on?
Well, that's what I'm allowed to tell you.
Cool.
Okay, so Frédéric Bourdin is born on June 13th, 1974. Did you notice anything about that day, Ian?
It's the day Nicholas went missing.
Correct.
Obviously, it's the day Nicholas went missing.
Not the same year, though.
No, but it's the day.
Yeah. Well, he went missing in 1994, while Frédéric was born in 1974. It's just one of those insane, freaky coincidences. Anyway, Frédéric is born in a suburb of Paris to an 18-year-old mother named Ghislaine. Now, like Nicholas, his father wasn't around and his mother dealt with addiction issues. Throughout Frédéric's childhood, Ghislaine struggled to look after him. He bounced around various family members' homes and spent a lot of time in youth shelters. He was an outcast at school and often misbehaved. Like Nicholas, he was caught stealing.
There's sort of a lot similar about them, isn't there, really?
Mm-hmm, there really is. And at age 16, Frédéric was living in a youth shelter. I think it was in a city called Nantes. Anyway, wherever it was, he didn't like it. So he decided to run away and he hitched to Paris. Now, this is a pivotal moment in Frederick's life because it's the first time he decides to take on a false identity. When he arrives in Paris, he's hungry. He's scared. He decides he needs help. So he approaches a police officer on the street and he tells the officer that he's a tourist, a British teenager named Jimmy Sale, and he's lost.
Who's Jimmy Sale?
Well, he's actually no one. Frederick just totally made him up. So the officer brings him back to the police station. However, once they discover that he speaks zero English, Frederick realises the jig is up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of obvious he's not an English lad. He confesses who he really is, and then he's sent back to his youth home. But this event sparked something in Frédéric. For the next few years, he would do the same routine over and over again. He would run away, adopt a new identity, always one he'd completely made up, and approach the local authorities asking for help. According to Frédéric, his goal was to find, quote, the perfect shelter. So in other words, he's hoping that one of these false identities would land him back in actually a nicer living situation.
I mean, it's very clever. It's also... heartbreaking.
Pretty heartbreaking. He just wanted a nice life, really, didn't he? Between 1990 and 1997, Frederick would travel all across Europe, taking on dozens of false identities. In November 1993, he actually arrived in the French town of Auch and literally just lay down on the street. When concerned citizens approached him, he looked at them longingly but didn't say a word. He just pretended to be mute. He was taken by firemen to a hospital. This identity gained him quite a lot of attention, and a local newspaper ran a story about him saying, "Where does this mute adolescent come from?" By the mid-90s, Frederick had accumulated a criminal record for lying to police and magistrates. He'd also gained himself a spot on Interpol's watch list.
Oh, wow.
So that brings us up to October 1997. Frederick is living in a youth shelter in Linares, Spain. However, there is a problem. As we know, by this point, Frederick is 23 years old. So his shtick impersonating teenagers is becoming a bit harder to pull off. And the truth is, being a missing adult is not quite the same thing. I mean, you don't get taken in and looked after in the same way. He's just been told by a child welfare judge that he has 24 hours to prove that he's actually a teenager. Otherwise, she would be taking his fingerprints, which are on file at Interpol. Frederick is panicked, so he comes up with a plan. He asks for permission to use the telephone in the shelter's office, and he calls the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, the NCMEC, in Virginia. Speaking in English, which he's picked up by now, he says his name is Jonathan Durian, and he's a director of the Linares shelter.
So he's impersonating teenagers, he's impersonating adults, he's Leonardo DiCaprio in Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, I don't feel like he's doing it well though. Like, you know, he doesn't have the accent down and the acting
skills. But that's explained, actually that's just explained, because I said, how did this guy that's clearly not the son get forwarded on to thingy? And that's because he forwarded himself onto them.
Yeah.
Clever.
He says that a frightened child has turned up on his doorstep. They can't figure out any details about him except that he speaks English and has an American accent. Bourdain offers a description of the boy that matches himself. Short, slight, prominent chin, brown hair and a gap between his teeth. He asks if the centre has anyone like that in their database.
Oh my God. So it's like he's literally shopping for an identity he can
steal. Quite a clever move, isn't it?
Really clever.
So the woman on the other end of the line, she has a little quick search and she tells Frederick that he may be talking about a young boy named Nicholas Barclay who's been missing for 3 years. Frederick says, yes, maybe it's him, and he asks the centre to fax over information about Nicholas. The woman says that she will mail overnight Nicholas's missing person flyer and immediately fax a copy as well. Frederick sneaks over to the fax machine. The printout of the flyer is very faint, but he sees a slight resemblance between himself and Nicholas. Obviously, can't see the different eye colour at that stage.
Yeah.
So he gets back on the phone and says, I have some good news. Nicholas Barclay is standing right beside me.
I mean, obviously this whole thing's really tragic, but like that is clever by the, well, not so young lad.
Mm-hmm. But then the next day, the actual flyer arrives in the mail. And according to Frederick, when he saw the picture of Nicholas more closely, he immediately realised this was going to be way harder than he thought. But he was in too deep now. So he dyes his hair blonde and he even asks another person in the youth shelter to give him some makeshift tattoos to match Nicholas. Remember, because
tattoos. Oh, we forgot about the tattoos.
The J, the T, because that's such a giveaway.
We should have just got them to see, look at the tattoos.
Basically, when Frederick learns that Nicholas's sister is coming over to collect him, he completely panics. As we know, Carrie is 100% ready to accept that he is her brother.
Yeah, that's the part that still baffles me.
Well, you have to imagine, Carrie hasn't seen her brother for 3 years. She's flown halfway across the world. She's tired. She's emotional. Her family have been falling apart since Nicholas disappeared. So she's desperate. Like, she wants it to be him. Do you know?
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing. Because what's the alternative? I actually have a quote from her. She told the New Yorker a few years later, "Your heart takes over and you want to believe."
I can totally see that. I would be the exact same, I reckon. That's totally understandable.
And I'm never going to come home now. It's going to be a 23-year-old French lad living in my house.
Yeah, it's not ideal.
I really wanted him to be Laura. Okay,
I wanted him to be Laura so bad. But it's his French accent and his penis that got in the bloody way.
Stop it, Jesus Christ.
Oh, you're not Laura. You've got a hairy
facial hair.
Chest. Not nearly as hairy as Laura's.
Okay, I do need to dig a bit deeper into the Barclay family because there's more.
Bloody hell. More.
It's sort of understandable that Kerry might be swept up in the moment. Do you know what I mean? It's really hard to compute how Frederick could have been living with the family for a month and hadn't seen through his disguise. Do you know? Like, at the start, you can see. But now, like, they're a month together.
Yeah. He doesn't know anything about the past.
He was 13 when he went missing. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've developed a lot at 13. Yeah. You've got memories.
He's not got the tattoos. His eyes are a different colour. He's got a French accent. After a month, you'd be like, right, this is ridiculous now.
When Beverly, that's Nicholas's mother, gets a call from Charlie Parker saying, it's not him, ma'am, it's not him, she basically point blank refuses to accept that Frederick isn't her son. And the thing is, as Charlie Parker's suspicions are growing about Frederick, so are the FBI's.
Yeah.
By November 1997, Nancy Fisher at the FBI also has figured out that something is definitely not right with the situation. In fact, she had Frederick sent to a specialised child trauma psychiatrist under the pretense of getting him some help for the abuse he faced. But really, she wanted to hear from the psychiatrist whether he thought Frederick was really Nicholas, which of course he didn't. Specifically, the psychiatrist said that it was impossible for a person to completely lose their native accent in the space of 3 years. So now Nancy Fisher is on the case along with Charlie, and she visits Beverly's home in order to take a blood sample. I mean, they should have done this from the start.
I mean, it's mad they didn't do this at the very beginning, but anyway. Yeah.
So take it from her and also from Frederick to see if they match. According to Nancy, when she arrived, Beverly lay on the ground and started wailing, saying she was not going to give a blood sample. In the end, they basically had to physically force her to come down to the lab and hand it over.
Well, I'm guessing she knew what the results was going to be, isn't it? And she just didn't want to believe it.
Yeah, it's very, very strange behaviour. Maybe she just really wants to believe. Maybe there's something else. So Beverly's behaviour seems so strange. And actually, so does Jason's behaviour. Do you remember I said about the half-brother?
Well, I think, ironically, Jason's behaviour now seems the most normal.
Yeah, actually, yeah. But he didn't come and see Nicholas. Even when he visited, he didn't really spend any time with him. Basically, what I'm trying to get at here is there are a lot of people like Charlie Parker, and actually Frederick himself says this, who believe that it was in fact the Barclay family who potentially had something to do with Nicholas's disappearance, and they may know what actually happened to him.
So this kid showing up could actually be their
alibi.
That's crazy.
But here's the thing, Jason dies of an overdose a few months after he goes to visit Frederick at Carrie's trailer.
Yeah, that could be too much for him to
Something happened or if he was involved, there's a lot of things to question. So I'm sorry to say this, we will never know the actual truth because I feel like a lot of it died with Jason.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Beverly vehemently denies anything to do with Nicholas's disappearance, as does Carrie and the rest of the family. It really is all conjecture. There's no solid evidence to back up his theory, but I thought it was important to mention as the big part of the coverage of this story.
Part of you goes,
I think I know what happened.
What do you think happened?
Like, this is just my opinion. I don't think that boy is alive. And that would make sense why Jason couldn't even look at him at first. Maybe Carrie didn't know. But I feel Jason knew more. And the fact that he dies of an overdose a few months after, it just all feels...
Yeah.
Very questionable.
That's our opinion.
Also Frederick's opinion.
And Frederick's opinion.
So I'm going to go back to Frederick because just like Beverly, he refuses to give a blood sample to the FBI because he also doesn't want to be counted. Like, both of them are playing roles. Both of them know they're not related.
Yeah.
But they don't want to give up the situation.
They're mutually beneficial for one another.
So he's forced to do it. Also, don't forget, like, Interpol has his...
Oh, yeah, fingerprints.
Yeah. So he gives him the fingerprints, I guess, as well. It takes no time to figure out who Frederick actually is and that he's been lying the entire time. In March 1998, he is arrested and charged with perjury and obtaining and possessing false documents. In September 1998, he pleads guilty to the charges and is sent to prison for 6 years, which is twice as long as is recommended by the sentencing guidelines. But I guess the judge probably felt that this was an exceptionally horrendous example, which involved lying about being abused and wasting so much money and resources for the police and the FBI.
And also, I mean, to look a mother in the face and tell her that you're her long lost son.
I think there's a bit of him as well, though, because he never had that love from, he probably wanted love from a mother. Yeah, like, it all goes back to childhood trauma. After serving his time, Frederick returns to France. And despite spending all that time behind bars, he actually hasn't learned the error of his ways because in February 2003.
But was he about 40 at this point? All right. My name's Leo and I'm a 14-year-old boy. Are you?
Well, yeah, you're right. He assumes the identity of Leo Bali, a 14-year-old French boy who'd been missing since 1996.
Oh, who'd been missing since 1996. Still, though.
I just like to hear you do the voice. I'll just let you go.
Hello.
Do it.
All right, my name's Timmy and I'm 7.
Look at bloody Luke, the darts player. You don't know?
Oh, Luke Littler.
Luke Littler.
Oh, my God. What if Luke Littler...
isn't the 16-year-old someone else?
Is actually Frederick.
That would make more sense.
Oh, my God. Luke Littler is Frederick. We're on to you, Luke Littler. No teenager can be that good at a sport. Don't you lie to me.
Back to the actual story. Mm-hmm. In August 2004, Frederick goes back to Spain and pretends to be a boy called Ruben Sanchez Espinoza, whose mother had been killed in the Madrid bomb attacks. And in June 2005, he passes himself off as Francisco Hernandez Fernandez, another Spanish orphan. Sorry, Hernandez Fernandez is just hard to say.
Francisco Hernandez Fernandez. Now, sounds like he's making up the name as he goes along.
To be honest with you, I'm not sure if those last two identities are real people or ones they just made up.
No way. My name's Francisco Hernandez Fernandez. Hernandez. Where are you from? Oh, Hernandez Street in Hernandez. Have you got a brother? Yeah, my brother Hernandez, my dad Hernandez Senior. Do you know Phil and Gary Neville, the footballers? Do you know what their dad's name is? First name?
Is it Neville?
Yeah, it's Neville. Neville, Neville. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Imagine your surname's Neville and your mum and dad go, probably call him Neville, I reckon. Jason Manford's got a really funny bit of stand-up he used to do where he went, have you ever done that thing where you fill out a form and he's put his surname Neville and he's gone, I've put that in the bloody first name bit. So then he just puts Neville in all the boxes. But yeah, if your surname's Neville, your mum and dad shouldn't call you Neville. But there you go. Gary and Phil Neville's dad is called Neville.
Neville, da, 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 da.
Neville. Neville, Neville. Da, da.
Fair play. Good parenting skills. Got great kids.
Yep.
And his sister, I did a netball thing with his sister before.
What's her name?
Revel.
Revel. Yes!
Basically, what I'm trying to say is Frederick never learns his lesson.
Basically, no.
He's up to his old tricks.
He's fran tangendo, mangendo.
Is he ever going to change? I hear you ask.
No, well, he just carry on doing this forever, basically.
Well, Frederick, actually, believe it or not, he's getting a bit older now. He's fallen in love. He's got married. He had a child.
It'll be a great line to the kid about Santa and stuff.
And Charles like, who am I? According to this interview he did with The New Yorker in 2008, all these events have made him turn over a new leaf.
Finally.
He wants to be present for his wife and his daughter. He doesn't want to be somebody else. And there haven't actually been any stories about him shape-shifting since then. But who knows?
I'm not so sure.
Well, we can keep tabs on him, Ian, because he is on TikTok.
No! Shut up.
That's
what?
The joy is about. Like, everybody has a social media presence.
Oh, my God.
No matter who they are.
He's got... can I click on it? I'm clicking on it.
Click on it. It's there to be clicked.
He's got 20,000 followers. Mm. Look,
it's all in French, though.
Oh, my gosh. So exciting.
Anyway, he's doing well. He's got a family. He seems to be thriving. But we'll never know what actually happened to the real Nicholas. And I'm going to finish off there.
Such a mad case. A real shame we didn't manage to find Nicholas in the end. But this Frederick guy seems like quite the character. I'm very excited about.
There's loads more stuff you can see. There is a documentary about it because there's so much stuff on interviews.
So did you watch? I never watched a documentary about this.
Who did I watch that with? Someone else. They've actually footage because they have footage of like this family. You can imagine it's a big news in America. This family being reunited with their kid. Where they think it is the kid, and then you see him doing interviews about being the kid, and then after a while...
I am an American boy, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, that was a long episode, but can we squeeze in one email? I've got an absolute doozy here, by
Please.
The way.
Please, what's
it's
it
It's from Mo, but it's about our cream egg episode. You ready?
Yes.
Hi, Lauren Ian, spelt correctly. I love listening to your podcast on my walk to and from work. It's a great mix of crime and silliness, and I look forward to it every week. Thank you very much. That is what we aim for. I was convinced your episode about the cream egg theft was an April Fool's, as the episode was broadcast on the 1st of April. I was going to smugly write in and say, ha ha, you've not fooled me. But I Googled it and it appears to be true. Anyway, it got me thinking when I was a child, I think about 8, I tucked into a cream egg and to my horror, it had no yellow yolk. For some now inexplicable reason, I was outraged about this so much that I wrote to Cadbury's to complain. Their response, I got sent an apology and a £25 voucher to spend. Keep up great crime telling. And that's Mo from Huddersfield.
Again, you're talking about cream eggs and you're not bringing the chocolate to the table.
Can't get them now.
Somewhere you'll get them. You'll get them in some pound shop somewhere.
Not through official means. And this is a BBC podcast and we are only doing things the proper way.
Don't forget, you can email us at laurandian@bbc.co.uk or suggestions, recommendations.
Case suggestions, get them
pictures
in.
Pictures of your pets.
laurandian@bbc.co.uk and pictures of your dogs.
And you can find us doing stuff on social media under the hashtag MTWpod.
Murder, They Wrote is a Mags Creative production for BBC Sounds.
The key sources for this episode include articles from The New Yorker and The Guardian, as well as a Netflix documentary called The Imposter.
For Mags Creative, the producers are Ryan L, Kit Milsom and Rowena Henley. Research and scripting is overseen by Rowena Henley, with support from Eloise Lushina. The editor is Kit Milsom. For BBC Sounds, the commissioning editors are Louise Cattenhorn and Dylan Haskins. The assistant commissioning editors are Natasha Johansson and Sarah Green.
I told you it was unbelievable. There's so many more episodes ready to listen to right now on the Murder They Wrote feed. And if you enjoyed that, head right over there and follow to catch up. But just before you do, remember to follow your next podcast right here so you don't miss any of this amazing series I'm going to be bringing you. And you can find all my recommendations along with news, reviews and much more on Podcast Rex at www.podcastrex.com. That's www.podcastrex.com.